This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink, inspiring public curiosity about food. Learn more at mofad.org.
This week on Meat and Three, we bring you stories about the coldest, darkest season. We start in a California vineyard.
It's cold, but it's wet, and things are still alive. There's a lot of life in this soil.
We explore two frontiers of cocktail culture: luxury ice, and the rise of non-alcoholic drinks.
The rocks traditionally becomes 25% of your drink's volume, and as such, it imparts smells and tastes.
And we investigate the risks facing New York City delivery workers during the harsh winter.
In the wintertime, after 2 hours of biking, it's quite easy, actually, for the bikes to sing upside down or slips or slide.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat and Three, that's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, for some food for thought to sustain you through the dead of winter. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey gang, just a quick announcement for New York area listeners. I will be emceeing the Star Chef's Rising Star Gala and Ceremony at Capital in Lower Manhattan this coming Tuesday, February 19th at 7 p.m. If you would like a discount on tickets, use the promo code Andrew at checkout, and you can get to the Eventbrite ticket page by visiting starchefs.com and navigating to their Rising Stars section, which is easy to do. You can also go to tokeland.com/appearances, which is the event page on my blog, and you will see a listing there for the same event. You can also click through to Eventbrite from there. Again, for a $15 discount on tickets, use the promo code Andrew at checkout. I hope to see you there.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stone.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins. And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
I also remember when the very first prosciutto di Parma, uh-huh. The very first prosciuttos came into the country. And I remember reading about it in the New York Times that they were going to come, and I called up my gourmet food distributor, and I said, are you guys going to get this prosciutto di Parma? So yeah, we're going to get it, but it's going to come on the bone. And my restaurant, we never dealt with a prosciutto on the bone, and prosciutto is really hard and mm-hmm. unwieldy and mm-hmm. hard to cut, and you put it on a slicer, and that's why you have it boneless and blah, blah, blah. And so I was determined that we're going to be the first place in Portland that's going to have this prosciutto. So I had to bone the prosciutto out myself, which I can't believe I didn't end up in the emergency room. And somehow I did it, and it went on the menu, and it was such a feeling of achievement. I guess what's behind that is the appreciation for a great ingredient and that has a taste of the place where it's from, and being, being brave enough to be able to just showcase that mm-hmm. on a course and not muddle it up with other stuff that it didn't need.
That is Chef Kathy Wims of Portland, Oregon, our guest today on Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, and I am just thrilled to bring you this episode today. Kathy Wims is a chef I had never met. If I'm really honest, this is, a bit of geographic blind spotting on my part. I didn't know much about Kathy. I'd heard her name, but she has been, since the late 1970s, cooking in Portland, Oregon. For a time, she was one of the owners of Genoa, a local institution in Portland that's been closed for some time. She was not the original owner, although that restaurant does date back to 1971, the same year that Chez Panisse opened. You'll hear the story of how she and some friends took ownership of that restaurant at one point. And then she opened her current restaurant, Nostrana, which has also led to other restaurants like Oven and Shaker. We talk about that in the interview. Kathy is someone who really lived out the, whatever you want to call them, the days of the American Chef Revolution, the days of the birth of the American Chef, This time, to me, a magical time, as many of you know from listening. I wrote a book about it. I don't need to keep plugging the name, but I think you know what it is. It's a personal fascination of mine. But she was right in the thick of this whole movement as it was viewed from Portland, Oregon, which is quite interesting. She's also chosen to specialize in Italian food and authentic Italian food. She is not somebody who feels the need to reinvent the wheel, as so many chefs do, which I think is both approaches are fine. But she has really put herself in the service of classic Italian food to the point where there is a Marcella Hazan recipe named as such on her menu at her current restaurant. And it has been there from day one, and she says she will never take it off. And I think that says quite a bit about Kathy's approach to what she does. I think it's a rather selfless act and a very, seemingly anyway, egoless act. We met while she was in town last week doing a dinner with Sarah Jenkins at Porsena Restaurant, Sarah's wonderful Italian restaurant in New York City. We met the day after the event. We borrowed the bar at Porsena, and we had limited time. Kathy's on a whirlwind tour through the city, had come from a late lunch, we had to clear out in time for them to start opening the bar. So we had what they call a hard out. I did my best to manage the time and get as much of her life story as we could into this interview. I also do want to say that I think this interview would make a wonderful companion listen to the interview that precedes it in our queue. Both of these episodes are dropping on February 13th. The other interview is with a young chef named Joel Gargano of Grano Arso Restaurant in Chester, Connecticut. And as I explained in the intro to that show, Joel is 34 years old, a creature of the Northeast, a product of cooking school, somebody who does what I guess you would call interpretive or modern Italian food. It's a much fancier take on Italian food, a slightly Frenchified take on Italian food. So they both operate in the Italian milieu, but that's basically the only similarity between these two chefs. They're different geographically, generationally, stylistically, and I thought it would be very interesting to hear them in close proximity to each other, which is why we're dropping both episodes on the same day. If you enjoy that experience and you're a new listener, you might want to revisit from last year. We did the same thing with two interviews with Chef Charlie Palmer and Chef Claire Welly that ran back to back. This is very much in the same mode. So I wanted these episodes to run individually because I thought both of these chefs deserved their own episode. But I would love it if you listen to them one right after the other. All right. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to my interview recorded with Chef Kathy Wims about a week ago at the bar at Porsena Restaurant in downtown New York City. Here you go. We're meeting at 4:30, but you just finished lunch.
I did. I just finished lunch. I don't know how many hours. We started at 12:30, so okay. 12:30 to 4. Yeah.
That's healthy.
Long lunch.
Tell us where you were.
We were at Le Bernardin, okay. Which is, I think, the be-all, end-all place to dine at in New York City, in my personal mind. I know there's a million places here, but to me it's like the most elegant European experience. It's like you walk into this room and you're in Midtown and suddenly the whole world disappears, including all of Manhattan, and you're just in this like special, amazing place for however long it takes you to enjoy your lunch.
Amazing. I mean, it's striking to me that you went to a French restaurant, given how Italocentric you are.
Italocentric? Yeah. Yeah, that would be me.
Yeah.
Well, actually, the real truth is I started off being a complete food Francophile.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like most young chefs, I think there's two things. I think one, they choose Italian food or they choose Chinese food or Japanese food. It's like those are like considered the top of the top of the top, and like that's what I want to learn and everything. And so I think you can go either route there. But for me, I was a total Francophile, and I cooked my way through Julia Child, and I read Richard Olney, and I loved Jacques Pepin, and then I went to Italy, and then everything changed.
Everything changed.
Because this food that I was eating. I was like, this is the most simple food, and it's so perfect, and I'm so relaxed and so happy, and it's so satisfying, and oh my God, maybe this chicken fricassee like had 5 ingredients at it maximum, and yet every part of it was perfect. And I just said, I thought I knew how to cook Italian food. I thought that was something, you know, it's really easy. You cook some pasta, you make a sauce, you throw some, you know, and back then I probably would have thrown some roasted red peppers or some goat cheese on it, you know, like right. Totally not Italian things. And then I was like, oh my God, I don't know anything. And I told myself, it's like, you don't know Italian food and you better relearn it. And it's going to take you a few years.
Right.
Like maybe 10.
So I must admit, we have limited time here. We're in a bar. We're squatting here, basically.
They're going to set up with permission in an hour. Yeah.
They're setting up behind us, and we have a hard out in an hour because customers are going to come in. So I have to admit that I'm at a bit of a loss for how to allocate our time, because your story, if you don't mind a compliment, if I may, your husband's right here, so I'm assuming it's okay. I'd seen pictures of you. I didn't really know your whole biography. I didn't realize, having seen photographs of you, that you were around for the whole thing. You were around for the whole American Revolution. No, but you were. You started cooking, what, in 79?
I moved to Portland in 79. I was cooking before that. In college, I was a private chef for a couple of professors at University of North Carolina. And I had a baking job in what we used to call natural food restaurants, mm-hmm. which we would call vegetarian now. And it was the best restaurant in my hometown, which is Chapel Hill, North Carolina. So those are my first jobs.
Yeah. So even more so.
'76.
Yeah.
Maybe.
When the whole thing was happening around this country.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What are your first memories of gravitating toward the kitchen?
Well, my mother was a really good cook.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to say that my loving, dysfunctional family was held together by great food and Labrador retrievers.
Okay.
So food was always something that just really soothed everything over, and you know, dinner time was something that, even if it could be stressful family-wise for me and my sister and our parents, at least we had really good food in front of us all the time. And my mother, she didn't know how to cook when she got married, but she taught herself, and she ended up cooking her way through Julia Child, like many people of that era did. And she had the Foods of the World Time Life series. She had, you know, every copy of that. And so I think I just sort of absorbed it from her, and just this was something pleasurable and really fun, and something that I realized that I could be good at. And there were mm-hmm. a lot of things that I loved that I knew I couldn't ever make a profession out of, like being a modern dancer. Or,
that was something you think you might have liked to have done.
Or teaching. I was a Latin major in college. Yeah. It's like, I wasn't going to be a Latin professor. You
uh-huh.
know? I knew that I wasn't that good.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the one thing I realized. It's like, oh, I could probably do this.
You had a natural aptitude.
Yeah, yeah.
When you look back now at that time, and we should say, by the way, you know, you said a lot of people did it, cooking through the Julia Child books. I don't think a lot of people realize this. Julie Powell, who wrote Julie and Julia and got a film deal and everything, she was maybe like the 1,000th person to do that. There was a whole generation of people. Some of them became very famous chefs who did exactly that. Your mom was just one of many. But that was a thing.
Well, it was so, I mean, what was so amazing about those books is that, one, it was like picking up a foreign language, like how to learn a foreign language kind of book, because the cooking was this language and nobody knew that language. And yet Julia Child like was so in depth and detailed about it and made sure that you were going to succeed if you really followed. And a lot of people, I remember back from that era too, it's like, oh, I never cook from that. Everything's like, every recipe is 3 pages long and I don't have that time and I can't read it. I'm going to skip to the end and just make it. But she methodically set it up so you would succeed, but you had to follow her methodology.
Yes, but also a lot of those recipes aren't that complicated. A lot of it's because she's making them foolproof. She's telling you what it looks like, what it smells like how much it should be simmering. Like, it's the
How to make an omelet. I mean, how many pages is that in her book? It's probably 4 pages. I don't remember, but but you, if you follow it, you'll make an. You can teach all your ex-girlfriends and boyfriends how to make omelets, you know?
So you grew up doing that. When you look back, do you feel like your mom and then you, by extension, do you feel like, were you guys actually good cooks? Like, do you think you had a good palate as a kid? Do you think what you were doing was pretty sophisticated?
You know, I think that's a really good question. I think I had a pretty good palate, but I think back to what I was saying, like, when I went to Italy.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't really know the whys and wherefores and why, and I didn't know restraint. Like, I think I thought more was better. And, you know, like I was saying, roasted red peppers and goat cheese. I mean, how silver palate is that? Like, let's talk about that era, too. It's like, I mean, all delicious ingredients, but you don't need them all at once. And so that was a long learning curve, I think, for me, personally. Mm-hmm. And the paring away, I mean, I think it's probably how any person learns their trade, really. Like, you get all excited and everything's all new and this is great and that's great, but they're not all great together.
And there's also, I think, an element when you're young of, I don't know, I feel like this is more true of guys than of women, but there is this element of, like, when you start to have chops, like, you want to show off, you want to show what you can do. And I think as chefs get older, a lot of times, as you're saying, like, you understand, like, restraint, simplicity, like, those are real virtues. And harder.
It is harder, because there's nothing to hide behind, right?
Right. So, I know Italian's your thing. Can we just talk about your whole French era for a little bit, though?
Oh, sure.
So, what was your... I mean, that was kind of what most people in this country, if you got interested in food, all the things you just named are French, right? Like, Olney's books have French in the title. Julia Child's books have French in the title. Her television show was The French Chef. If you went out to a fancy restaurant in most cities in this country, it was French food. I mean, you kind of didn't have anything to choose from, right, coming up, or did you?
You know, I don't think you did really have much to choose from. I mean, I think you start learning to cook. I was actually a vegetarian when I started to cook. And I got so interested in cooking that I didn't want to limit myself. And I guess where I'm going with that is that, like, you read about something like, let's just say classic French things like duck à l'orange, and you want to make it because you've heard people talk about it, and it sounds so elegant and fancy. And sometimes your first try doesn't turn out that well, and you're like, I don't know if this is such a, you know, what's so great about this, but. But then it is, like, you know that it can be great because you've heard about it for so long. So I think you kind of want to conquer it, and you want to get to the bottom of that recipe and, like, figure it out. Like, what shortcut did I do that made this not so extraordinary, you know, that made me slightly disappointed? And I think that's a great way to learn.
Yeah. So you... do you mind if I play narrator a little bit? Because we have limited time. This is stuff I would usually have a guest do.
Okay.
So you grew up in Chapel Hill.
Mm-hmm.
You go to college in North Carolina. You then moved to San Francisco.
I did. How did you know that? I didn't know you knew that. That's funny.
Because I did my homework.
Okay, yeah, thank you.
I did my homework. So you moved to San Francisco, and from San Francisco to Portland. And I've heard you say in multiple interviews or read you say, essentially, you were following the bouncing boyfriend.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
You know, 21, 22.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of that at that time. Mm-hmm. A lot of people ended up being San Francisco chefs instead of, like, New Orleans chefs or New York chefs because they were dating someone who moved west.
I mean, can you imagine, like, being, a, you know, 21 years old and growing? I went to college in my hometown.
Mm-hmm. Majored in?
And I was Latin major, but I was taking a ton of modern dance, which there wasn't a major in, so I was wasting a bunch of credits on that. And then to, like, be in this small town, university town, which had good restaurants, but... You know what university town food is like, you know? It's more like about being varied and being, you know, international and ethnicity, cuisines and all that. But it's, you know, it's not usually extraordinary. And then to go to San Francisco was just like this food mecca in 1978. And, like, there was this restaurant in San Francisco called Caravanserai. And it was like this Moroccan, you know, like stuff from all over Caravan Place. And it was just kind of, to me, that was sort of a symbol of San Francisco. Like, oh my God, there's all these places I can try, you know, and all these different cuisines. And it was so vibrant. And then...
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
What other places really pop in your memory from that, from being San Francisco at that time? Did you spend any time in Berkeley, or were you mainly confined to the mainland?
In 1979, my last night in the Bay Area, I ate at Chez Panisse.
For the first time?
For the first time. Okay. It was my going away present. And literally at a table very close to mine, was James Beard was sitting there dining at
the
same time.
Oh my gosh.
I remember exactly what I had, too.
Did you know who he was?
Of course.
Of course.
He had a syndicated column.
Yeah?
And I read it every week.
And at that time, what was her... How did she loom in your consciousness at that time? Like, she's become such a figure, right? But did she have that air about her that early?
No, because the Chez Panisse menu book, cookbook, which was her first book, hadn't come out yet. I remember I'd already moved to Portland when that came out. So for me, it was just this place that everybody talked about and said, you have to eat there.
It wasn't like she wasn't like a, like almost a large, she didn't have that larger than life aura yet.
I mean, maybe I was naive and just didn't know, but no, it was just a famous place, and it was her restaurant my mind.
So you go from there to Portland, and what's your pathway into professional kitchen life there?
Well, so I moved to Portland, and to me, Portland was, I feel like it's going back to the medieval period. Like, everything was... It's just gray, and it was raining all the time. I moved there in March, and it rained 30 days out of... Are there 31 days in March? I can't remember.
That's a good question.
And and I was like, where am I? And everyone spent time in pubs drinking, like, cheap beer and playing pool, and they would have... The windows would be, like, blacked out. And so I thought, why did I do this? And it was not a culinary scene. There were a few, like... places that were sort of like little bright lights of paradise food wise, but not so much.
Did you feel like I've spent a lot of... We were talking before we started taping. I've spent a lot of time in the Pacific Northwest. It now, I think, in a very charming way, but back then I'm trying to imagine that it can feel like you're kind of like at the end of the earth over there. Like you're far from every... You know what? You're not that far from Alaska. Like,
that's true.
It's true. You know, like, people come through on these short flights from Alaska there. Like, it is, you're way on the edge of the world, right? In terms of it for an American. Did you just feel like you were like at an outpost in the middle of nowhere at that time?
I did. It felt very like a Western frontier kind of outpost.
Mm-hmm.
But that had its own advantages, too.
Like what?
Because Portland has always been a place where you can make a name for yourself without really any... You can start from scratch because that's like the frontier way, you know? You can totally start from scratch. You don't have any baggage about, you know, I came from this family or, you know, I'm known in this social circle.
It's meaningless there.
None of that's meaning. Yeah. That means nothing there. And so I think that's why Portland is such an amazing happening food city now, is that... People could just make a name for themselves, or you could, you know, you could buy a paper and become the editor of the local paper. You know, I mean, those things happened, and I hope they're still happening. I'm not sure as much as when I moved there, but really it was really pretty easy.
Yeah, it's interesting. This is very much the way people talk about San Francisco back then.
Okay.
You know, people use the term the Wild West. They talk about, I mean, certainly in restaurant life, I remember Patty Unterman saying to me, you know, the reason, because there's this disproportionate number of women who were able to be in kitchens in the Bay Area, going back to the 70s, the 80s, to like any other Western hub, right?
So you mean there were
more
women
in kitchens and as chefs and chef owners.
It's true.
And Patty Unterman said to me, she's the San Francisco chef, she said, that's because we were all opening our own restaurants. We weren't trying to get into other people's restaurants.
It's true, you know.
And you're describing Portland very much in those terms.
And I know. And somehow it was just easy to do that. There wasn't like the ceiling that you had to break through. You just could be your own self-made person, really.
Did you perceive that as distinct from where you came from? Was that like a palpable difference, or do you only realize something like that looking back?
You know, I'm glad that you asked that question, but because I never really thought about it that hard. But yeah, I think so, because I think, you know, I went to college in my hometown. You grow up, you know, you're 18 years in the same place, and you want to go away. I mean, who wouldn't, right? You want to go to another city to go to college, and I didn't. And, you know, it's financial, and it was a good school, so it's not like any hardship. But I think that I felt like to really go anywhere in a career of any kind, you know, maybe I had to go to a more famous school, maybe I had to go somewhere else. Like, I think that would, at that time in my mind, would give me validation. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of disappointed to go to school in my hometown. Although, you know, in retrospect, it was great, and I got to be kind of a big fish in a, mm-hmm. in a little town, which, because I knew the ropes, you know.
Right. So you were spared the, like, acclimating to, like,
yeah,
a bigger city or just a different place or different climate or, mm-hmm. yeah. Okay. So you get to Portland, and what's your first job there?
My first job?
Oh, you just lit up when I asked that.
So I got picked up by my boyfriend. We were talking about my boyfriend. Yeah. He picked me up at the airport, and before he took me to where we were going to live in this house with two other guys, he took me to a bar. And this was kind of the opposite of the bars with the blacked out windows and the that I was telling you about and the cheap beer. This place was called Produce Row Cafe.
Produce Row.
Okay. It was in the produce district. Uh-huh. So there was all the Italian groceries, produce companies were down there. It was in the industrial part of Portland. You've probably driven through it. Mm-hmm. And so, again, this is 79. I'm like, I just moved to this town. I've never been to Portland. And then he's driving me through this industrial part of town, and there's railroad tracks, and there's, like, dirty, you know, vans and parked everywhere, and, you know, homeless people. And I'm like, what's this? Why am I here? And so he takes me into this bar and then, you know, orders me a glass of beer. And then one of the owners of the bar is working. It was Saturday, late lunch, and he leans across the bar, and he says, hey, does your girlfriend need a job? And my boyfriend says, yeah, she does. And I was working there the next day.
Doing?
Slinging sandwiches and pouring beer. But they were very good sandwiches. Okay. And the windows weren't blacked out. And there were ferns in the windows. So that felt very San Francisco. Remember mm-hmm. all the fern bars and everything?
Right.
So it was a nice pub. It was like a nice tavern. Tavern is the word that I should probably be using.
I've heard you say that this is surprising to me for someone of your talents now, but that sandwich making did not come naturally to you.
Do you know what the best thing is? I was the worst sandwich major they ever had. They were embarrassed by my sandwiches.
Where did you go awry? What was the problem?
Oh, we'd start, there was a base for most of the sandwiches. They were like big French roll sort of, I guess you could call them grinder kind of sandwiches. Mm-hmm. Actually, Philadelphia cheesesteak, they were kind of a bastardization of that. I'd never been to Philadelphia back then, so I didn't know. But you start with this base of griddled onions, and sometimes there'd be peppers and mushrooms in that. Well, I was famous for burning the onions and using too much of, we called it the griddle grease, the whatever that hydrogenated oil that we cooked with. So I would use too much of that because I didn't want it to stick, and I didn't want to have to brick the grill at night when it was really dirty. And so I don't know why they let me stay working there, but somehow they didn't fire people very often. No, of course not.
No. Okay. Now, can I just ask who this is? Where are we now? This is 80, 79?
Yeah, 79, 80.
Okay. Who is working in a kitchen at a place like that in Portland at that time?
Oh, college graduates, college dropouts, you know, a lot of...
So this is very Berkeley.
Yeah, there were a lot of trust fund friends of mine, and there were people that were just, We were stoners. I mean, what do you think we were?
Well, that's an interesting point. So somebody once said to me, you know, there's this, there's all this sort of noble talk around the food movement, right? Like you talk about Berkeley, you talk about Chez Panisse, and everyone talks about, you know, the commitment to farmers and foragers and sustainability. And somebody said to me, you know, what nobody really talks about is that there was this huge piece of all this that was just pure sensual pleasure. Like young people, and, you know, some of them, yes, they were high, which definitely accentuates all that, but just really learning to just really go nuts with food, you know, go crazy with food, mm-hmm. that there was just this pure, you know, like in Berkeley, there was like a garlic festival, you know, like,
oh yeah.
But fresh garlic even was like a new thing to a lot of people. Most people had only seen like powdered garlic, right? But this is what you're talking about. Like even these sandwiches, these are like really deeply satisfying, unabashedly flavorful.
They were really good sandwiches, yeah. As long as I didn't make them.
As long as you didn't make it. But in principle, the idea of them was something that this, but in, we all take this for granted now. You could get food like this anywhere, right? But this was like a new movement, really.
It really was. And I think there were these other things going on too. Like Portland had this really famous grocery store called Corno's.
Okay.
And you've probably heard, and this is not a grocery store, but you've probably heard of Powell's books.
Oh, I was just there during Feast.
Like,
yeah.
It's like the Strand here,
yeah,
right? In New York City. It was amazing. And when I would have friends come visit me from North Carolina or from the Bay Area, would come up to Portland in that era, I did two things. I showed them two places. I took them to Powell's Books, and I took them to Corno's Grocery.
Mm-hmm.
And Corno's Grocery on a Saturday was like an international souk. Like, it was amazing. Like, there was all kinds of languages being spoken. This place was huge. It was more interesting than the Berkeley Bowl. I mean, mm-hmm. I really think it was. And unfortunately, it's no longer there, but it was this great grocery store. I mean, you could find North African ingredients. You could find, they had, again, 79. They had like a huge, it was almost like the size of a keg, but an olive oil container, like the size of a beer keg, where you could fill up your own bottle of extra virgin olive oil from California.
Right.
I mean, this place was like,
you don't
amazing.
Even see that at Whole Foods.
Like, I know.
You can get all the drug stuff, but you can't tap an olive oil keg.
So,
just give people a sense, if you can remember, what would be like one or two things that you would see in a market like that, that at that time were revelatory?
One ingredient, it's like one day I showed up at this market, Corno's, and there was this huge tuber, and the sign said, "Try yammy, YAMMI, and it was some African tuber that, you know, probably had some kind of sweet thing, or could have been, you know, even like something they might use in the Caribbean in mm-hmm. their ground provisions kinds of staples. And I mean, just that, the exposure to that kind of stuff. And I think that that is what fueled, you know, all these like artistic people that kind of turned to, I think in the way that I did, to cooking, because like maybe they weren't going to be the most famous ceramicist in America, or at least even just support themselves doing that, but they could do something arty with this, with food and with this variety of ingredients and this nearness to amazing things. Like, I remember the first time I moved to Portland, I had wild salmon. I'd never had that. I mean, salmon disappeared when I was growing up on the East Coast, and I'd never had salmon. And the taste of like Chinook salmon, you know, fresh, was, oh my gosh. Or I remember I walked outside of the tavern that I was working at, Produce Row Cafe, one day to take out the recycling of the beer bottles, and there was this truck that was like parked, a van, a grocery van, full of morel mushrooms. This, and I went up to the guy, I said, "Are those morels? I've heard about them. I'd never eaten them. I'd seen a picture. I thought they were." I said, "Are those morel mushrooms?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Where are they from?" He said, "You know, we collect them, you know, around Portland." And I said, where are they going? And they were going to Washington, D.C., to Jean-Louis and the Watergate.
Can we just quickly explain? Jean-Louis Paladin.
Thank you.
Amazingly, a lot of people don't know who this is, but do you want to do it or should I do it?
No, I think you should do it.
Okay, so Jean-Louis Paladin was a French chef who looked like a mad scientist, who I believe, again, this year was 79 is such a huge year.
And he was from Gascony.
Yes, he was from Gascony, and sweet, just this unbelievable character, right? Like, super talented. People talk about his food in a way that I rarely hear people talk about anything. A young Thomas Keller used to save his money to go to D.C. twice a year and eat at Jean-Louis at the Watergate. But he also unusual for a French person of that era, had a real affection for America, had a real affection for American products, and spent a lot of time, no pun intended, cultivating relationships with farmers and getting them to grow certain things or getting people to, you know, send them like crayfish from down south. And he would incorporate a lot of this stuff into his dishes.
So he was a Frenchman that truly embraced American ingredients.
Yes.
And heralded them on his menu.
Okay,
anyway.
So again, because of our limited time, I'm going to play narrator. Our heroine finds her way to, is it Genoa?
Genoa.
Restaurant. How did you get there? Well, first of all, what was it and its history, and how did you find yourself there?
So there were a few outposts of amazing restaurants that everyone in Portland in the early 80s considered like the special occasion restaurants.
The local institutions.
Mm-hmm. And one was called Genoa. And that was a 7-course Italian prefi meal. The word on the street was that you could never get a reservation. You had to wait like 2 years to get in. It really wasn't true. It's the same as it is now. You know, if you want 7:30, 8 o'clock,
right.
You might have on Friday or Saturday night. Yeah,
yes.
Maybe you can't get in for a while. So I had saved up my money to eat there a couple of times, like probably in the course of 1 year. And always dreamed of, like, this would be my dream job if I could ever work at this amazing place. But I would never have applied because I didn't go to culinary school. I was self-taught. I just thought they'd laugh at my face, you know. So I didn't. And then by sort of through a friend of a friend, I was literally, you know, working in my tavern that, you know, pouring beer, and a phone rings, and my friends come and say, hey, Kathy, the phone's for you. And it was the owner of Genoa calling me to ask me if I would come in and interview for a job. And I must have dropped the phone and ran out to my friends in the dining room and said, oh, my God, I just got this call. And
This is like in an old cartoon. You were like a puff of smoke.
Absolutely.
Your legs like spun and you were out the door and
completely.
That was it.
Completely.
Yeah.
It really felt that way, you know? I remember I ran out to tell a friend of mine, and the first thing that he said was, well, what are they going to pay you? I said, why would I ask that?
This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. Featuring a variety of interactive displays, MOFAD encourages eaters of all ages to be curious about food. The museum currently operates MOFAD Lab, a 5,000-square-foot experimental space in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where Chow, making the Chinese-American restaurant, is currently on show until the end of March 2019. This exhibition celebrates the birth and evolution of Chinese-American restaurants, tracing their nearly 170-year history, and sparking conversations about food culture, immigration, and what it means to be American. It highlights the evolution timeline of Chinese-American restaurant menus, dating back to 1910, and also highlights a tasting section where participants get to enjoy tastings created by the country's most talented chefs who specialize in Chinese-American cuisine. Make sure you check out Chow while you still can. The exhibition closes at the end of March 2019. Check out MOFAD's tastings and extensive event calendar at mofad.org/events.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Coral Lee, and I'm the host of Meant to Be Eaten here on HRN. Every week, I look at cross-cultural exchange in food and contemporary media. What determines authenticity? What, if anything, gets lost in translation when cooking foods from another's culture? You can find Meant to Be Eaten wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to the show. We'll get you to the rest of our interview with Chef Kathy Wims in just a moment. Just a quick reminder, if you would like to follow the show on social media, the best place to do that is on Instagram. The handle is at Chef Podcast. That's at Chef Podcast. We do drop a post there every time a new episode goes up. You can also subscribe for free on Stitcher and iTunes. And if you're so inclined to leave us a review at the iTunes store on Apple, it really does help people find the show, and we'd really appreciate it. And with that, I'm going to return you now to the conclusion of our interview with Chef Kathy Wims. I hope you enjoy the rest of it. As much as you can remember, right, this far removed from it, you grow up, you again, not a lot of choices in cuisine for a young American who's like getting interested in quote-unquote serious food, right? So you have all these French reference points, right?
Right.
How did Italian food strike you? Like, what distinguished it in your mind and drew you to it?
Well, it took me to go to Italy, like I said earlier, to realize that I really didn't know what Italian food was. Like, what I thought about Italian food was, you know, my dad took me to Mama Leone's in New York City. And,
right.
And there was, like, a huge provolone on the table with
Italian
huge celery sticks and olives.
Italian-American food. But so, what about Genoa? How authentically Italian was it when you first arrived there?
I'd say it was a blend of French and Italian.
Okay.
You know, I think it was past the point where people were using that word continental cuisine.
Right.
Like, I think we were, you know, beyond that. But it still had a lot of vestiges of that. So, so actually, it was very eye-opening to actually go to Italy and see, yeah, oh, this is Italian food.
This is really Italian food.
Yeah.
So what was the occasion of your first trip to Italy, and when was that?
Well, I ended up being lucky enough to buy Genoa. And
this was in partnership, yes? With some other former...
Yes, there were three of us.
Yeah.
This was a very hippie story, and the owners, the woman that hired me, she and her husband owned the restaurant for 10 years. They were already the third set of owners of this institution, and they turned around and one day offered it to their senior employees, which was just kind of this made up, you know, bar of like, oh, if you've worked over 7 years or more, you're a senior employee. And so it was this very hippie sort of, they were Reed College, one was a grad, one was a professor, and it just had this real countercultural thing, which kind of made the place work too. And then they just like offered it to seven of us, and four of us ended up buying it
together.
Yeah, but now, it's the opposite of me going and saying, hey, Andrew, want to own a restaurant
right
together? You know, it's just like, they just like dropped this thing in our lap, and then it's like, oh, maybe we'll be partners. Oh, maybe, you know, none of it had ever occurred to us.
Right. Did you, can I ask just in broad strokes, was the business deal as sort of egalitarian as the notion was? Like, did you pay as you went? Like, how did you, what were the terms?
It was almost, they literally gave us the money they had in the savings account in the bank. Like, I remember part of the deal
the
was like
account.
$80,000 in the bank.
Oh,
they
God
wanted us to succeed.
Oh,
isn't that amazing? Can you imagine that in
so
this
can
day
I,
and age?
Did you just like, they? Did they just get a piece of the action or?
No, they wanted to move on with their life.
Oh my gosh.
But they didn't want the restaurant to die. They
right
believed in it.
Amazing.
And
this is like,
you know,
almost impossible to imagine today.
It's totally impossible.
In fact, it is impossible to imagine.
It fell in my lap, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I was just very, very lucky.
So,
and they were very generous.
So was that the moment when you thought I should get over to the homeland?
Yes.
And
you know why? Because when that happened, I became the person that was in charge of buying the wine for the wine list. And so I was, you know, entertaining wine salespeople. And then they would, when there were Italian winemakers in town, because we had the most important Italian wine list in
mm-hmm
Portland, I would meet these Italian winemakers. And then they would say, oh, you know, if you want to come to Italy and visit the winery, we have an apartment you can stay in, you know. And I was, that sounds nice. And so that was how my first trip to Italy happened. And that's when I realized that the food that I thought that I was making, that I thought was Italian, which I'd only learned through cookbooks and magazines, and that I really didn't know what I was doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you knew what you were doing. You just weren't doing...
I mean,
you weren't
good
doing
at being hard
authentic,
on myself,
authentic
yeah.
Italian.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so what were some of the things that really stand... What were some of the revelatory sort of things that you ate or even just were put in front of you and you just thought, oh my God, when you were over there?
I remember one of the first dishes that I had, it was a carpaccio, and it was before carpaccio was like everywhere, and so it was, you know, like really wonderful rare beef on a plate with some shaved celery and celery leaves and kind of a aioli garlicky mayonnaise thing and maybe some black pepper. And that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, I mean, so what was that, four ingredients maybe?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, this is delicious. And then followed by that was pasta, this typical pasta of Piemonte, Angelotti, Dalpine, like tiny little meat-filled, like tiny ravioli kind of, that just were like smaller than cherries.
Usually served like in a napkin, right?
Yeah, or in broth sometimes too, butter and parm.
Yeah.
And every little bite was just like the texture of it and the filling and the I know, just the way it unfolded in your mouth. Like, I mean, that was something much more complex in a way of, you know, learning how to make those and everything.
Sure.
But just the purity of that was just what was so impressive.
So what was the effect on someone who grew up, again, with all these French references, with all the work it takes to master, not that Italian's easy, but, you know, like for me as a writer, when I think about French versus Italian, and I mean, I love Italian food. I think about like when I was growing up and wanting to write, Scott Fitzgerald was like my hero, right? And then I read Hemingway and I thought, oh my God, he's so brilliant and look how much more simple it is, you know? And I always think of that when I think of French versus Italian. Not that one's easier than the other, but the end effect as a reader, or in the case of food, as a diner, it's a completely different experience.
It's kind of too, like, I think of Miles Davis, and it's like, what are the notes that you don't play are as important as the notes
Love
that you
that.
Play?
Yeah. You think of that in connection to food.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So how did you start re-educating yourself, or how did you start educating yourself on this pathway that you set yourself on?
Oh, my God, what did I do? Oh, I know what I did. I just threw my hands and I just threw myself at the Italian people that I knew. And I said, what do you think about this dish? What do you think about it? I was like, so I would do...
this is back home in Portland, you mean?
Yeah, so there'd be, like, winemakers, you know, coming, Italian winemakers, and then I would do a dinner featuring their wine at the restaurant. And then, I would have come up with the menu, and then I'd say, what do you think? And... what I realized very quickly was that Italians won't tell you, they usually politely won't tell you if it's bad, but they never tell you if it's good unless it's real, unless it's good. Like, and so to get this approval of these like Italian winemakers, like if they said that a dish was really good or a meal was really good, that they had eaten of food that we prepared in my restaurant, then if they said that was validation and that I'd gotten somewhere.
Okay.
It's really kind of, actually that was kind of my, what do you call it, measuring stick? I don't know.
Yeah, your standard or your yardstick. Yeah. Did you, are there one or two dishes that you remember making that you were sort of like tumblers falling into place for you?
Where you everything thought, like worked
where
out?
You're like, or where you're like, oh, I'm getting it.
Well, one, mastering the pasta that I just talked about, the Angelotti Dalpine.
Mm-hmm.
I probably shouldn't use the word mastering. Maybe that was one. I also remember when the very first prosciutto di Parma, uh-huh. the very first prosciuttos like came into the country. And I remember reading about it in the New York Times that they were going to come, and I called up my, you know, my gourmet food distributor, and I said, "Are you guys going to get this prosciutto di Parma?" So yeah, we're going to get it, but it's going to come on the bone. And my restaurant, we never dealt with a prosciutto on the bone, and prosciutto is like really hard and mm-hmm. unwieldy and mm-hmm. hard to cut, you know. And you put it on a slicer, and that's why you have it boneless and blah blah blah. And so I was determined that we're going to be the first place in Portland that's going to have this prosciutto. So I had to bone the prosciutto out myself, which I can't believe I didn't end up in the emergency room. And somehow I did it, and it went on the menu, and it was such a feeling of achievement that I was so silly. I came home and sang, to sing to my boyfriend. It's like, "Hi, bone the prosciutto." Like, I had this whole like nursery rhyme song. And uh-huh. I was like, but
you surprised yourself.
Well, I think I guess what's behind that is the appreciation for a great ingredient and that has a taste of the place where it's from, and being, being brave enough to be able to just showcase that mm-hmm. on a course and not like, muddle it up with other stuff that it didn't need.
Mm-hmm. Eventually, Genoa closed what? Maybe how long ago?
10 years ago, maybe. Okay.
So tell me about tell.
There's people here that might know that.
There's one or two general questions I want to ask you, but tell us about your current places.
I have I own three restaurants right mm-hmm. now. None of them I own completely by myself. There's two restaurants, Nostrana, which is 13 years old, which is, I would say, my baby.
That's like your flagship.
That's the flagship, mothership that I own with my husband, David. Mm-hmm. And then we just recently expanded it to Enoteca Nostrana, which is a next door, beautiful, modern, Milanese kind of wine bar mm-hmm. in style, with cocktails and two private dining rooms. So those are the two places I own with my husband. And then I have two other partners, business partners, in a pizzeria cocktail bar, craft cocktail bar.
With a great name.
Oven and Shaker.
Yeah, can I ask, who came up with that great
my
name?
My partner, Ryan McGarian, who's an amazing mixologist.
Oven for the pizza and Shaker for the drinks.
Oven is the pizza and Shaker is
It's a great
cocktails.
Name.
Thank you. I thought it was really, he's really good at coming
up with
names.
It's like a perfect
names.
Name.
Thank you.
I think it is anyway.
It's cute.
So, you continued basically, if I understand your chronology correctly, the sort of evolution you started at Genoa is continuing on in your current in Nostrana.
It is. I would say the evolution is continuing, but also I think going back to like my epiphany of going to Italy and realizing how simple food was that because my old restaurant Genoa was such a special occasion place, and literally as cooks we had to answer the phone all the time. So we took reservations. That was part of our job. So you could be burning a soup and the onions for a soup, and you're like on the phone taking this reservation that's taking 15 minutes answering all the questions.
Yeah.
But the point of that being is that people would say, "Oh, I need a reservation. It's my anniversary, and we've come every year for 20 years. Or it's my wife's birthday, and you've got to get me in because she'll kill me. I mean, right. We've been doing this for 30 years, you know what I mean?" And so, and it opened, Genoa opened the same year as Shape and Eats in 1971.
Amazing.
Okay, now I've lost my train of thought. It was about,
well, the question
about
was about you continuing your evolution from there to your current.
So from going to Italy and realizing how simple the food was, it was not simple to bring that simple food like back and serve it in the special occasion showcase of a restaurant, because people expected more fireworks.
Bells
and everything.
And whistles.
Exactly.
Right.
And so that grew frustrating for me, and because that's the food I really wanted to make, was this simpler food, and to hopefully people would get excited about that and enjoy it. And so really Nostrana was the result of my wanting to make that kind of food, so as opposed to like super fancy dining out,
to create the proper package for that kind of food.
Yes.
Okay, so I hate to ask a gender question when my guests don't bring it up. Do you mind if I do, though?
No, I don't mind.
You know, something clicked in my head when I was reading articles about you and what you do and the way you're talking now about Italian food. You know, there are a lot of restaurants in this country right now that are diligently serving traditional Italian food, right? Trying their best to kind of... We're sitting in one right now.
We're sitting in one of the best.
Now, overwhelmingly, I believe most of these restaurants have women chefs at the helm. And I felt for a long time that women chefs often don't have what I call the transformational imperative that a lot of men do. They don't feel the need to, well, this thing we talked about with young chefs earlier, to show off, to reinvent the wheel, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's really fascinating how many, you know, here in New York, we have Sarah here, there's, you know, Jody Williams, there's, mm-hmm. There's a lot of these restaurants around the country. I think most of them are helmed by women, and I find it very interesting. Does that comment make sense?
I do think it makes sense. I never had the experience of being in a male-dominated kitchen. I never worked in any restaurant that could ever be, you know, that would be that way. It was,
yeah.
There were tons of women working in Genoa when I started mm-hmm. working there. There were a few men, but there were most, you know,
right.
There were way more women. And it was also, I felt like it was a very cooperative experience. Mm-hmm. Like, we didn't have one head chef at Genoa. We had four people that were called menu chefs, and they would, they were in charge of the menu that was running for, in that case, a 2-week period. And we constantly were bouncing ideas off each mm-hmm. other. Like, we didn't have this, like, I'm making this, and, you know, my way is the highway.
Right, there wasn't that hierarchy.
Not at all. Yeah. We all were like, hey, you know, nettles are going to be in season, you know. I'm thinking about this soup. What do you think?
Right.
And we really worked, you know, with each other, and so I'm not the best to explain that, but I hope that some of the other women that you mentioned got to experience what I got to experience, too, and to learn in that sort of, I mean, I know nurture is a real overused word, but it feels like it was a sort of a nurturing way to learn about food and to grow as a chef,
well,
as opposed to, like, you know, being told no, or, you know,
sure.
that's not right, or no, you don't get any input on this menu because it's my menu, or...
Right.
Does that make any sense?
It does, but I'm also struck by the ability to find satisfaction. Even you a few minutes ago said, you know, you didn't want to say mastering, you know, the tortellini, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this idea of finding satisfaction and just getting better and better and better at realizing something that already existed, but that has a certain perfection to it, and wanting to get as close to that as you can. You know, I'm struck that you, I think it's still there, Marcella Hazan's tomato and butter sauce.
Never gonna leave the menu.
It's on your menu. It's always been there. It's a faithful production of this classic Marcella Hazan recipe,
right? Three ingredients,
but the fact that that is on your menu, you know, with that name, and that's, you know, you're cool with that, is to me, that to me says a lot. And I mean all this as a compliment,
by the way.
Thank
you.
Am I making sense?
No, I appreciate that a lot. I mean, I think it is. I relish paying homage. Homage.
I don't know. Are we going French or Italian?
You know, to all the mentors that I've been
yeah.
able to learn from. And
yeah.
obviously Marcello
yeah.
was one of the major ones.
Of course, yeah.
The major one,
yeah.
probably.
So just quit. We have to, you know, people are going to come in here soon and start making noise, which I guess...
Drinking cocktails,
make
eating
money
pasta,
here, right?
Yeah.
It's a good studio, though. The sound is really good.
It worked out.
The acoustics are good. But Portland, I was just there with the Heritage Gang during Feast. I hadn't been there in 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
You've been there a long time. What? I don't even know how to ask this question, but it's such an exciting food city right now. What's it like for you as someone who was there for sort of the, you know, the spark of this movement we're talking about, not just locally, but nationally? What's it been like for you to watch this place really flower over the last 20 years?
I mean, one, personally, it's great because there's a million places to eat that I love, and a lot of them are in walking distance of my very own house, which did not used to be the case a long time ago. Right. So there's selfishness that makes me really happy. There's I have the good fortune to like see, you know, former cooks that work for me like open their own places. Some of them started with food trucks. Some of them have their own, you know, brick and mortar restaurants. You
and
know,
some of the biggest chefs in town.
Yeah,
and Gabrielle. I don't want to mispronounce the last name. Gabriel Rucker. Gabriel Rucker. I mispronounced the first name.
Yeah, he worked for me.
He worked
a little
for
bit.
You. Yeah.
And so, you know, and I think I learned as much from him as he learned from me, you know. I mean, it goes both ways, and that's enriching for me, and I hope that it was enriching for them to work for me.
I'm sure it was. What's it like for you? How competitive is it there to keep cooks today? What's that phenomenon? You know, this is such a conversation these days. Is it as bad in Portland or as tough, I should say, as it is everywhere else?
I don't think it's as bad as it is some places. Like I have friends in the Bay Area that they're really hard keeping cooks, I think employees in general too, because it's so expensive to live in San Francisco or in, you know, Berkeley or wherever, that it's literally an hour and a half on a commute to get into their place of work, that it's just not worth it. Mm-hmm. They don't get paid enough to pay for that, you know.
Right.
Commute and the time and the quality of life and everything. And I don't feel like Portland is as bad that way, but it probably is going to be that way. I mean, there's tons of building.
Like maybe it's,
and there's just housing going up everywhere. And
it's coming.
And I don't think it's the housing that, you know, that a line cook can
afford.
Yeah.
It never is. Okay, last question. You started off wanting to dance.
Yeah.
Is there any... Look at you, still brighten when that comes up. Is there any correlation between what you felt, experienced, the satisfaction you got from it, of dancing, and cooking?
Well, I think... I hate to say, like, you know, cooking on the line with all these orders coming in and everything is kind of like a dance, you know.
Does it feel that way to you?
Yeah, you know, once you're in the groove and you're doing, you know you're going to make it, you know you're going to get those orders out and you're going to get them out in time and then it's all going to start again. And I mean, it happened here last night. You know, I watched the line cooks here. We had this big, you know, olive oil dinner at Porcena last night. Yeah, I mean, you see that, and being on top of it is kind of like, you know, the thrill you get from, you know, the athletic movement that comes from dance. What was the question?
If there was any correlation between what you got or felt from dancing and
euphoria.
Cooking.
I think that's euphoria. You know, everyone talks about the, you know, the rush of an evening, you know,
in the kitchen. This is like what runners call a runner's high.
Yeah, it is.
Where you almost aren't, you're kind of beyond the realm of thought. You're just sort of functioning.
Yeah, like, you know, maybe you're Michael Jordan and you're hanging in the air for a moment, for a second, and you feel like, oh my God, I really did do that. And then, of course, then, you know, it takes you hours to get to sleep after, you know, a night like that. So,
is it still like that for you after all these years?
I'm finally calming down.
Really?
It's really only within the last few years.
Did it take any special, like, do you have to meditate, or are you just finally learned to kind of flip a switch a little more?
No, it took a long time. Yeah, there's a certain kind of meditation. Yoga's helping me.
Yeah. Well, adrenaline is a powerful drug,
it's
right?
It's pretty intense.
Yeah. All right. Well, I could have talked to you twice as long, but I'm glad. Thank you for squeezing this into your visit.
Oh, thank you for having me, Andrew.
It was great to meet you.
Yeah. Thank you for such a great program that you have.
Oh, thank you very much. And that's our show for this week. Thank you so much for listening. Kathy Wimms, thank you very much for making time during your whirlwind visit to New York City. Helen Baldis, thank you very much for helping that interview happen. I'm really glad we did it. I enjoyed it tremendously. To Jeet, our new engineer, thank you for getting two shows up on the air this week. I promise I won't do that to you again next week. And to all of you out there in podcast land, thank you for listening and hope to see you back here soon on Andrew Talks to Chefs.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please, join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.